From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Paris climate talks are where the world has come together to try to finally save us from our carbon habit. But as the negotiators hash out who pays, who sacrifices, and how to make the planet-wide switch to renewables, some scientists and power companies say we cannot get to carbon neutral on wind and solar power alone. Is it time to get over our fear of nuclear power? This hour on Point, nuclear powering our way out of climate change. You can join us on air or online. Are you ready to embrace nuclear power? When scientists say that new designs are safer, do you trust them? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from the climate talks in Paris is David Unger, energy editor for the Christian Science Monitor. David, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So this summit in Paris, it seems that the leaders are coming together to actually accomplish something this time. What's the mood been so far there?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of optimism. The phrase that you hear a lot is that there's been progress, but we still need to do more. Obviously, with 150 heads of state in town for the opening day, there was a lot of energy and excitement and optimism. But now, of course, the hard part begins, and we are seeing, negotiators behind closed doors having their meetings, and that's when the real sort of horse trading begins. And so far, what I've been hearing is that a lot of that initial enthusiasm maybe isn't translating into the closed-door negotiating room.
Mm. Well, I'm reading, it's just crossing the wire, the Associated Press, that negotiators have produced a new draft of a climate agreement that's supposed to set the world here on a new path toward cleaner energy. This draft is 50 pages long. What do you know about that? At least it's something, huh?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of part of the process. These summits end up kind of just being an iterative process of very technical, bureaucratic copy editing, mm-hmm. essentially. And we have a new draft today that it seems like people are mostly happy with. It's about four pages shorter than the previous draft, which in the world of bureaucracy is sort of considered as progress, right? They want to get the options narrowed down so that when the ministers come into town to sort of make the final agreements, that there's a sort of more focused pool of options for them to choose from.
In an address to world leaders at the Paris Climate Conference on Monday, President Obama spoke about the U.S.'s commitment to using more clean energy.
Over the last 7 years, we've made ambitious investments in clean energy and ambitious reductions in our carbon emissions. We've multiplied wind power threefold, solar power more than 20-fold, helping create parts of America where these clean power sources are finally cheaper than dirtier conventional power.
And also on Monday, French President François Hollande addressed the other world leaders, spoke about the need for non-carbon-based energy sources. Here he is speaking through an interpreter.
We must see changes in the price of carbon fuels so that there is a real price tag put on the impact to the planet. Choices must be modified gradually, our choices in how we use energy, so that we make new technologies accessible.
There's President Hollande, President Obama. A lot of advocacy, David Unger, of renewable energy. Is the conference focused mainly on limiting how much carbon we all produce? Where's the focus specifically?
Yeah, I mean, I think generally the target that is the center of these talks is sort of the temperature rise above pre-industrial levels, and how much carbon emissions can we put into the atmosphere to a point that we raise the temperature to a dangerous level. And the stated goal is to limit that warming to 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels, but there are some nations here, particularly those that are most vulnerable to climate change, who are really pushing to get that even lower, to keep warming within 1.5 degrees Celsius. And that still is one of the big things that needs to be worked out in this final text. What exactly kind of pathway are we on? Because the current one we're on puts us if everybody completes their climate pledge, to about 2.7 or 3 degree rise. Mm.
So whatever the number there, is there a feeling that a global shift to low and zero carbon fuels is an obtainable goal at this point?
I think that's what makes this conference a little bit different than past ones. I mean, particularly if you compare it to Copenhagen in 2009, the world economy was in tatters. Renewable energy was still seen as this very expensive kind of burden that people had to take on. And now, I mean, the way renewable energy prices have plummeted, people are this really seems like a much more surmountable challenge to countries. And I think that's why you've seen so many countries step up to the plate and submit pretty ambitious climate pledges.
How much support is there for nuclear power at the talks in Paris?
You know, these talks tend to be pretty technology agnostic to some degree. I mean, the bottom line is just to get people to cut emissions, and they kind of leave it up to various countries to figure out how they want to do that. Hmm. So for some countries, nuclear, you know, is going to make a lot of sense and play a huge role. China is building all sorts of nuclear reactors, and they need all the sort of massive baseload power they can get for their growing economy and population. You know, countries like Turkey are also looking into this. The U.S., it's not playing as much of a role because natural gas prices have been so cheap. But, you know, that could change in the future.
Hmm. Just as we talk here, Congress has passed two resolutions to stop the president's climate policies in their tracks. How's that playing in Paris?
It's funny. It's actually not getting that much traction over here. It seemed sort of being met with a shrug. Todd Stern, the lead U.S. negotiator, had his first press conference asked about it yesterday. And, you know, his response was that countries have asked me about it, but I tell them that, look, you know, they don't have enough votes to override a veto. This is sort of a non-issue. Let's move forward. The Clean Power Plan is moving forward. So don't worry about it, essentially.
You know, it comes to my mind here that when you talk about countries being technologically agnostic, a huge success diplomatically can still be a climatic disaster, right?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I think one of the operative principles that people are talking about here is that we shouldn't expect Paris to fix everything, right? One climate summit is not going to save the world. But the goal is to implement some sort of mechanism whereby countries will come back to the negotiating table on a more routine basis and re-up their pledges, especially as renewable prices can continue to drop and it becomes easier for people to be more ambitious.
Mm. David Unger is joining me from the Climate Talks in Paris. He is energy editor for the Christian Science Monitor. David, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, joining me now from Washington is Josh Fried. He is vice president for the Clean Energy Program at the Third Way, a nonpartisan think tank. Josh, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So talk to us about nuclear energy in the United States. How dependent is the U.S. on nuclear energy?
So today, about one in five homes in the United States, 73 million households, get nuclear energy providing their electricity. It's 20% of – almost 20% of all the electricity that's generated, and about 65% of the clean zero emissions energy that's generated in the U.S.
Mm. So we hear David saying, you know, the cost of some of these alternative fuels continues to drop. What role do you see nuclear energy playing as we confront climate change?
Well, it's a great question. When we started looking at what we thought the optimal climate solution was, we looked at where other scientists and international agencies fell. And the International Energy Agency, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the White House under President Obama all came to the same conclusion, which is we need a mix that includes nuclear as well as renewables, as well ultimately as carbon capture, which removes the carbon being emitted from the coal and natural gas plants that are going to remain in operation. If we use all of the technologies available and get the mix right depending on what the cost is and where each technology is best suited, we can really take a significant bite out of the carbon emissions we need and get close to, if not meet, the 2-degree target that's been set. But it's going to take all of those technologies.
What about in the United States? You say 20% of our electricity comes from nuclear energy. Is that right? Could that be bumped up to 50%? I mean, do you see that number going higher?
Well, it's a key question, and it's one we're working on now. When you look at what's happening in the U.S., the big challenge, as David alluded to, is that we have very low-priced natural gas, and we have a misalignment of policies where the zero-carbon, always-available attributes of nuclear aren't taken into account when companies are making a decision as to what electricity they're going to buy. So natural gas is able to compete and bid into the grid at a lower price than nuclear. Essentially, it's less expensive despite the fact that it emits carbon, which we're trying to limit. Hmm. The other challenge is that the existing nuclear plants, while excellent, they don't scale to meet all of the variety of energy needs. Renewables are going to meet some of those, but we have a real opportunity to develop advanced nuclear, a next generation of nuclear that can be smaller to meet different energy needs, both for industrial plants, for smaller cities and towns, and it can be both more cost-effective, cheaper, and even safer than the plants that we have operating today. And it can consume the waste that nuclear plants produce as fuel instead of producing waste. Mm.
So are we talking about plants small enough to, say, supply a neighborhood? I mean, something the size of a truck or an electric substation, perhaps?
Yeah. It's fascinating. What we've seen over the last several years is that nuclear engineers at schools like MIT, at California Berkeley, are motivated by climate change and inspired by the technology revolution in all of these different industries. And they've taken a look at how they could build reactors differently from today and struck upon a whole bunch of ideas. Some could power remote military facilities in towns in Alaska. All of these could be fit on the back of a truck, delivered to the location, and dropped into a plant. So you have a whole wide variety of different options available.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about nuclear energy as a solution to climate change this hour. In the big debate about that, you can join the conversation. Does the idea of building lots of nuclear plants around the world spook you? Do we need more than just wind turbines, solar farms, and such to stop the growth of carbon in our skies and in our oceans? My guest this hour, Josh Fried, Vice President for the Clean Energy Program at the Third Way, a nonpartisan Washington think tank. Let me bring now a more skeptical voice into the conversation. Also in Washington, we're joined by Allison McFarlane. She was chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission from 2012 to 2014. Before that, she served on President Obama's Blue Ribbon Commission on America's Nuclear Future. Today, she is the director of the Center for the International Science and Technology Policy at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. Allison, great to have you. Thanks.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So you heard what Josh Fried said. I'm curious, can nuclear energy fix the problem of climate change that we face?
I think that it's important to maintain a diverse supply of electricity, and I think nuclear certainly plays a role in that, but it can't alone fix any of these problems.
So what's the biggest problem then? I mean, is it with nuclear power? Is it that you can't produce nuclear plants fast enough to change the cycle that we're in now, or how do you see it?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, if the goal is capping at 2 degrees warming, we have really very little time to act. You know, we really have to get moving by 2020 and in the 2020s, and we simply can't build and construct and operationalize nuclear power plants fast enough to really do that much. Let me give you an example.
Okay.
For China, China is the country that's building the most nuclear plants right now. And China right now gets about 2% of its electricity generation from nuclear, and they have about 21 plants operating. They have about 31 plants operating. They have 21 under construction. If they build out by 2030 to their maximum amount, that will still only be 10% of their electricity needs. Hmm. So it's even China, who is the most ambitious country in the world with nuclear power, their nuclear power is only going to do part of their electricity supply in the future.
But if the problem is scale, and it seems that nuclear energy isn't the only problem. And don't you have the same issues with wind and solar infrastructure?
Sure, absolutely. Wind and solar, right now, we can build a little bit faster than nuclear.
And so what will we need to address the global warming issue without significant increase in nuclear power?
Well, we need a lot of those renewables, absolutely. And as I said, we need a diverse supply, so nuclear is still a part of that mix. But it's not the answer.
Let's get some sound in here. Back in March of 2011, an earthquake and tsunami caused a major meltdown in release of radioactive materials in Japan from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Here's some Fox News coverage of that time.
Radiation levels now 1,600 times higher than normal. 1,600 times, and that goes up to 12 miles from Japan's crippled nuclear power plant. That zone has already been evacuated, and now folks within 18 miles of the leaking facility are being urged to stay indoors upon fear of radiation.
Josh Fried, jump back in here. How did the 2011 Fukushima disaster affect any moves toward nuclear energy initiatives?
Look, I think globally we did see several countries pause or start rolling back on nuclear, particularly Germany is the case example. Unfortunately, the result of that has been a significant increase in carbon emissions from Germany and an inability for them to meet their aggressive targets to reduce carbon emissions. And I think one point that Allison made that's really important to reinforce is we're in agreement. The world needs a very diverse supply of zero emissions energy if we're going to address climate change. And I don't know anyone who is saying it has to be or should be all nuclear. But just the same, it's likely not the best path to have it be all renewables either. She's absolutely right. We need a diverse supply of electricity, and it's going to have to be both nuclear from existing technologies, advanced technologies, as well as renewables and hopefully battery storage to back those up.
So help us understand, Josh Fried, how the private sector is responding here. How much money is being spent on this sort of innovation?
Yeah, we looked at this about a year and a half ago, expecting to see maybe a half dozen or so companies in the United States and Canada developing advanced technologies. And we were stunned to find there are 48 companies and institutions developing advanced nuclear technologies, and they're backed by over $1.6 billion and growing. And this includes investments from household names like Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos, Nathan Myhrvold, Paul Allen, and others who view nuclear as part of the solution and recognize that if you can develop a reactor that is cost competitive with fossil fuels, that can consume waste rather than produce nuclear waste, and builds upon the safety record of the U.S. nuclear fleet, which is excellent, thanks in part to work of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, then we have an even better chance of addressing climate change, which is what I think all of us are working to try to solve.
Let's get a caller in here. Many on the line waiting to get in. Patrick in Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, Patrick. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
I have a bad connection, but I just wanted to say that I have a very strong belief in the safety and efficiency of nuclear power. I know there's been issues in the past. I think that with government backing and proper research that we're going to overcome these issues. I like the comment that Josh made about neighborhood nuclear power plants. It sort of reflects, I think, Frank Lloyd Wright's concept of his self-contained communities that he was trying to design in the 1950s, and this is a discussion that we need to have right now, and we should have more of it. I appreciate the attitudes and the comments that both parties are making. I think they're sort of agreeing to a great extent with each other, although there are issues that clearly we have to resolve.
Patrick, thank you. Well, I wouldn't say you agree, Allison McFarlane, would you necessarily on some of these points regarding nuclear energy?
Well, I think that nuclear is, as I said, it's part of the mix already. We don't want to shut them all off right now, but it's not something that we should look to as the answer right now to the climate change problem. We should continue to do some research on this and to look at the innovative ideas that are coming out. But just keep in mind that from when you begin to design a nuclear plant to when you operate it, you're talking about at least 20 to 25 years.
And so what do you
at
do
the
about,
minimum.
What do you do about that problem, Josh Fried?
I think there are a lot of possibilities. The big challenge right now is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the United States was understandably designed to evaluate and license light water reactors. They know how to do that. They do an excellent job at it. That's also how they are funded. What we need to do is look at how can we and how can the NRC develop a new set of regulatory and evaluation processes built towards getting innovative new designs tested and deployed so that they are as safe enough, if not safer than the reactors today, but they provide the transparency, predictability, and affordability that new technologies need to get private sector investment and to get to commercialization. We've talked to folks in industry. We've talked to people involved with the NRC at the Department of Energy. And there's a really strong sense it doesn't have to take 20 to 25 years. The technology can be built and demonstrated within the next 5 years from a scientific basis. And if we get the regulation right, it can be done safely within about 10 years.
Patrick, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Steve now in Hampton, Virginia. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
There's nothing clean about nuclear power. Not today. Never has been. And Mr. Fried has made misstatement after misstatement. First, they're not zero emission. It takes an incredible amount of carbon dioxide to produce the high carbon steels and special concretes to make a nuclear plant. Second, he's completely avoided water vapor. You see those gigantic towers beside each nuclear plant? That's where a lot of water vapor goes straight to the atmosphere. Water vapor is a stronger greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So this whole premise is false. But anyway, we've never needed nuclear power. Never. It's only been because of government support. And you can hear that in the conversation today. Mr. Fried is kind of pleading to keep nuclear power around. It's never been necessary in the first place.
Steve, thank you. Josh Fried, respond.
Yeah, well, let's take a look at the United Nations IPCC evaluation of life cycle emissions. Nuclear actually emits, and this is not me, this is the UN, and this is why we came to the conclusion nuclear needs to be part of the solution, about 15 grams of carbon dioxide per kilowatt hour of electricity generated. Natural gas, 491. Coal, over 1,000. Even wind and solar, for the same reasons that the caller mentioned, construction, operation, actually emit more carbon dioxide over their lifetime than nuclear. It's a question of how do we deploy all of the technologies that we can deploy that do not produce emissions while they're generating electricity to keep the emissions in the world low and to bring them down. I think that, unfortunately, we've got a lot of work to do, but nuclear happily is going to have to be part of the strategy and provides a real opportunity.
Allison McFarland, speak to the caller Steve. You talk about scale, Allison. The caller Steve talks about nuclear waste, some of the safety issues associated with nuclear power. Does that concern you as well?
Certainly. I think that there are obviously safety issues associated with nuclear power. The Fukushima accident is an example of that. At the same time, in the United States, we have a very robust regulatory regime. We have nuclear inspectors at each nuclear power plant 24 hours a day, all the time, watching over the plant. So we operate them relatively safely in this country. At the same time, there is an issue with the nuclear waste. We have not solved that problem. In fact, no country has solved the problem of what to do finally with the nuclear waste from nuclear power plants. And that's something that needs to be addressed.
Let's get Jose in here from Miami, Florida. Jose, welcome to On Point.
Yeah, thank you.
Hello.
Yes, I just wanted to make a comment. I am a great supporter of nuclear energy. I am an engineer, a mechanical engineer. I worked for Westinghouse for many years from the 60s to the 90s. So we built many of the nuclear power plants that are in operation today. In fact, the two that are the Florida Power, 30.3 and 4, are of Westinghouse design. The comment I have, I don't know if it has been discussed or not, is that there are about 103 nuclear plants operating in this country, I believe, today, which represents about 19% of the nuclear energy. 90% of the electric energy. produce in this country. Now, those plants are very old plants.
Mm-hmm.
They are past the 40 years of operation. You know, these plants were designed for 40 years, based on the design. Like,
right, they're old. They're old, yeah.
It was extended to 60 by the NRC because the utilities were able to prove that they had a lot of safety factors in it. During those days when these plants were built, that was primarily computer time. It was all, you know, hand calculations, slide rule calculations, and a lot of testing. Every time we wanted to use a different material or there was a significant design change, it had to be tested.
So, Jose, I think I hear you saying that some of these new reactors might be better. Allison McFarland, I mean, does there need to be regulatory change here before some of these innovations move ahead? Some of today's regulations are tailored for some of the traditional reactors that Jose was speaking about, which makes it very difficult to commercialize new ones, as I understand it.
Yeah, Jane, thanks for letting me address that point that Josh brought up earlier. I think that we actually have quite a, as I said, robust regulatory regime. I think that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is more than ready to address these new reactor designs. In fact, they've been having regular meetings, public meetings, and meetings with some of these folks who Josh described, who are innovating and working on some of these advanced designs. So they're regular, they're ready. But it takes a long time to design and to get the plants and the applications ready for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So that's really where the hard work is. It's in that designing, in that development of the reactors.
Is that where you see it, Josh, in the design and the development of these new plants? Is that where the rubber meets the road, so to speak?
It's the design, it's the development, and the cost. And the NRC has done a very good job of engaging the public and engaging developers and others in determining what a process should look like moving forward, because this really is new territory. I mean, it's exciting that we have so many different companies and innovators and financiers coming in and saying, we can make nuclear even better. We can figure out technologies that can address the waste issue by consuming the nuclear waste that Allison referred to rather than producing more. So let's figure out how to do it and let's get it commercialized. And mm-hmm. there are opportunities to think even more creatively about how we can maintain the excellent safety record that the NRC has for the U.S. nuclear fleet and adapt it to a new model for innovating and commercializing nuclear reactors, because it's now the private sector that's engaging in these designs and development as opposed to a government-driven process the way it was 40 and 50 years ago.
Allison McFarland, do you worry about the proliferation of nuclear plants around the world? I mean, I read a lot about, you know, the corruption that leads to shoddy construction of some of these plants. Do you think that all countries can regulate nuclear plants adequately?
I think that's a really good question, Jane. And I think what's really important is that a country have a strong, independent regulator that has both the financial resources and the personnel to look at these plants, look at these designs, make sure they're safe, make sure that the construction goes safely, make sure they're operated safely. They have to have the backing of governments to ensure that if they want to, if they feel the need to shut down a plant, that they can. And it's not clear to me that everybody has that.
Let's get Jay in here from Tampa, Florida. Jay, I'm up against the clock. If you could be brief, go ahead.
Yes. Whether nuclear will, I think nuclear should be part of the solution, but the bigger problem is that it takes carbon hundreds of years to come out of the atmosphere. So even if we stop pumping it in today by going to nuclear power, we're still going to have to clean up the atmosphere to get the carbon out if we want to stop global warming.
Jay, thank you. It's an important point. We're discussing how we're going to power our way out of global warming this hour. Allison McFarland, Josh Fried, my guests. Whether we have to embrace nuclear energy and a big way to do that. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Much more to come, including more of your calls after this break. This is On Point.
On Point is sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support with just the right sink, just the right bounce. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for better nights and brighter days. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. You can try one risk-free for 100 days with free delivery and returns. Go to casper.com/onpoint. That's casper.com/onpoint. And remember to use promo code ONPOINT at checkout to receive a special offer. Terms and conditions apply.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. As negotiators try to work out a worldwide deal to stop global warming, we listen to the debate around whether we need to build a lot more nuclear power plants. And you can join the conversation this hour. Can we afford not to build a lot more nuclear power plants? Does climate change force us to embrace nuclear power again? The federal government wants to resume storing nuclear waste in Yucca Mountain, Nevada. And they've met, as in the past, with opposition. Here is Las Vegas Mayor Carolyn Goodman last month protesting a plan to transport nuclear waste across the state by rail and saying all the promises in the world from Washington and from the nuclear industry do not convince her that there will never be an accident.
They don't know where the fall's going to be. They don't know where the truck is going to spill. They don't know where the railroad is going to collapse on them. There is no way of knowing.
One concern there from Las Vegas about Yucca Mountain, Nevada. My guest this hour, Josh Fried, Vice President for the Clean Energy Program at the Third Way. Allison McFarlane, former chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and now director of the Center for International Science and Technology Policy at George Washington University. Let me bring in another voice now, Mark Jacobson, director of the Atmosphere and Energy Program at Stanford University. And he joins us from Stanford. Mark, welcome. Nice to have you.
Yeah, hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on.
Earlier this year, you and your colleagues published a study that argues that the planet could run 100% on renewables, wind, water, solar energy, by 2050, and that 80% globally by 2030. What's your reaction when you hear the public discussion about ramping up nuclear power as a major solution to climate change?
Well, I think it's a completely misplaced discussion, and it's never going to happen, so it's kind of a distraction. I mean, nuclear is clearly an opportunity cost. It's not as good as wind, water, and solar power. It could be arguably better than gas and coal, but still an opportunity cost relative to wind and solar. Just the cost alone, I mean, look at the cost of a new nuclear plant is around over 12 cents per kilowatt hour. If you look at Lazard, who's the most detailed cost estimate calculations, you know, wind is 3.7 cents per kilowatt hour averaged over the United States right now. It's one third to one fourth the cost. But, you know, that's not even the cost is not even the major issue. There was a number about emissions presented earlier, 15 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour from nuclear. I mean, that's a nuclear industry estimate. This is a problem when we're, you know, people are citing nuclear industry estimate numbers. I mean, there was two meta studies of over 100 studies of nuclear cost of emissions. And those meta studies started at 60 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour as averages over all those 100 studies. But that's not the only CO2 emissions associated with nuclear. You have the fact that, as was stated earlier, it takes almost 20 years to plan, permit, construct a nuclear power plant, and where it takes 2 to 5 years for a wind or solar farm. So in the meantime, while you're waiting around, if you spent your money on nuclear instead of wind and solar, you're waiting literally 20 years before you actually generate a single bit of, quote, clean energy. Mm. And meanwhile, you're running coal plants and gas plants. And so that caused another 100 to 200 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour, and that brings it up to almost half of natural gas. So if you compare with wind, nuclear puts out 9 to 25 times more carbon dioxide equivalent emissions than wind power. And so it's an opportunity cost. But that's not even not the major problem. I mean, 1.5% of all nuclear reactors ever built have melted down seriously. And I mean, there are 440 nuclear reactors in the world, and about 40 were shut down in the last few years. So there are really only 400 that are operating. And 1.5% failure rate is pretty bad. And then 5 countries of the world have secretly developed nuclear weapons capabilities under the guise of civilian nuclear energy programs. So, you know, if we wanted to power the world for all purposes, not just electricity, I mean, electricity is only 20% of all energy. And so, you know, we'd need 16,000 to 20,000 850 megawatt nuclear plants to power the entire world for all purposes. We have 400 today, and that's a decrease. I mean, we're not even increasing, even though China may be producing 20 more plants. I mean, that's not even getting up to the 440 that we had a few years ago.
So you cited the more CO2, the 9 to 25% times more CO2.
25 times more.
Right, the nuclear disaster implications. I mean, so from your perspective, when would we start? What would we be doing? How fast can we start seeing real results? Say, you know, 40%. Is it 2 years? Is it 10 years? I mean,
By the time we get the next nuclear power plant up, the Arctic ice will be melted. It'll be past 2030. I mean, in the U.S., there's one plant it started planning in 2007. It won't even be up for probably, because of delays, it won't even be up for maybe 2020. But that's just even one. And so, meanwhile, you know, we need to get rid of 80% of emissions by 2030 to keep carbon dioxide levels below, you know, around 370 parts per million. I mean, you need 80% reduction. The only way we can do that is to mobilize large-scale clean renewable energy. And clean renewables, wind, water, and solar, and that's by 2030, get 80% reduction. And it won't happen if we even talk about nuclear.
There are some scientists, as you know, who said, well, even that's too late. Even now we're too late for that.
No, we're not too late, actually. I mean, if we can actually get 80% reduction by 2030 and 100% by 2050, by the end of the century, we'll be down to about 370 parts per million, and that will save us. But, you know, anything besides that, you know, the plans are, all the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change plans will have us way over 400 to over 500 parts per million, because these emission reductions are way too little. I mean, so we have to focus on the things. The key is to focus on the most efficient technologies. Even though nuclear is arguably better than gas and coal, it's not as good as wind, water, and solar. And so every dollar you spend on it is one less dollar you're going to spend on a better alternative that's going to get us to where we want faster.
Allison McFarland, jump in here. Do you agree with what Mark's saying?
Sure. Yes, but first let me say I don't want to commit news here. The federal government doesn't want to resume storing waste in Yucca Mountain. There haven't been any decisions on that. So,
okay.
But back onto Mark's points. I think
he
makes quite a few excellent points. I think being very pragmatic and looking at the U.S. situation, I don't see us building a lot of new nuclear power plants in the future. Actually, there are 5 nuclear reactors under construction in the United States. One, Watts Bar, will probably come online in the next year or so. It's an old design, and it's been revived. There are 4 new ones under construction, and Mark is correct that they'll come online right now. The target dates are 2019-2020. But there are quite a number of plants that are in the process of shutting down, or a few have just announced that they will shut down. So we're going to sort of stay about even for the near future. But really, the issue is that I don't see the nuclear industry investing or the utility industry investing in new nuclear anytime soon. In part, demand has shifted in this country. There have been population shifts. The recession really affected demand. And you had the rise of cheap natural gas. Add that to the restructuring of the electricity market, where you have large parts of the country where you might see demand increases that have been deregulated. You're just not going to build nuclear power plants in deregulated markets right now. So over that, the next 5 to 10 year time horizon, it's a very difficult situation for nuclear in this country.
Josh Fried, how do you see it?
Yeah, look, I think that unfortunately, you know, the idea that Mark is peddling is actually counterproductive to addressing climate change. His own plan talks about needing a World War II style mobilization to get to anywhere close to the kind of rollout of renewables, 80%, let alone 100% renewables, that are needed to decarbonize. It also talks about building an enormous amount of new offshore wind. And, you know, the example is 55% of the electricity in Massachusetts, 55% of it would come from offshore wind. And we saw at Cape Wind how hard it is and how much time it takes to even get those plans considered, let alone built or not built, as in the case with a lot of these projects. Similar obstacles are being run into with some of the existing onshore wind proposals. Offshore wind is also very expensive. But there's another point that we're running into now, which is when some of the existing plants are decommissioned and they stop producing electricity, they are not being replaced by renewables. they're being replaced by natural gas. And we saw that with Vermont Yankee. When Vermont Yankee, which is a nuclear plant in Vermont, as the name suggests, went offline in late 2014, the power that it was initially replaced by was mostly coal. So you had a zero emissions energy source replaced by a very dirty carbon emitting energy source. Even the Sierra Club warns that when Pilgrim, which is a nuclear plant in Massachusetts, closes, and which currently produces, depending on the week and year, about 74% of the zero emissions energy in Massachusetts, when that goes offline, it will be significantly replaced by natural gas. So what we're seeing when the existing fleet is retired, we're actually falling backwards in our ability to try to reduce emissions and address climate change. And if we take nuclear off the table, we're going to find ourselves much in the same way that Germany has experienced, with in some cases much higher energy prices and a much longer lead time to get to the kind of deep carbon emissions that the UN, that Jeffrey Sachs at the Earth Institute in at Columbia University, that President Obama, and that Carol Browner, who was his former climate czar, all described as necessary.
Mark Jacobson, there sound like there's some real obstacles with the wind, water, solar solution. Does it change your optimism at all?
No. I mean, what Josh says is just completely false. I mean, 60% of all new energy in the United States this year is solar plus wind. So you can't say that, you know, shutting down a nuclear plant has resulted, has been replaced by coal, when in fact, you have to look at the whole U.S., and most of it is solar plus wind. And New York, in fact, has a new mandate, a new law that will get us to 50% by clean renewable energy by 2030. I mean, this is, and you should know that, and that's 62% of our 80% goal. And California has the same laws as well now to get to 50% clean renewable, that's clean renewable, not including nuclear, wind, water, and solar. And so, in fact, the United States just introduced a resolution, the House of Representatives, Resolution 540, for the United States to go to 100% wind, water, and solar just 2 or 3 days ago.
Yeah, I saw that. Let me go back to the phones here because a lot of people want to join us. George Ann is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
One thing that I do know that Ms. McFarland just talked about are the new units that are coming online.
Mm-hmm.
We live in Columbia, South Carolina, which is very close to the Vogtle plant. Both my father and soon my brother are going to be working there in construction. There's 5,500 jobs on site there, and I know that hasn't been really mentioned, but it is really such an economic boom for our area. We love the Southern Company. They contribute to charities, tax base, support the schools, everything. So we are really, really happy to have them there.
George Ann, thank you. They're in Columbia, South Carolina. From Madison, Wisconsin, Mike is on the line. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on.
Yes.
I think this whole discussion is futile.
Okay.
You know, electricity is only a portion of the entire energy use by an individual. The United States consumes over three times the amount of energy per person per year as the rest of the world average. We're adding 3 million people a year to the United States, and each one of those is going to need clothing and food and shelter, and they're going to want to use their Twitter, they're going to want to watch NASCAR, they're going to want to go to the store and drive their cars. And what you're talking about here is only one fraction of the energy consumption, whether it's nuclear or wind. And wind is not clean. You know, how do you build a wind turbine? Concrete and steel, fiberglass, and epoxies that emit 10,000 times the global warming potential of a CO2 molecule. I mean, we're emitting so many more complex molecules into the atmosphere by all these compounds we've created. This is a no-win situation.
Mike, thank you. A lot of needs, a complicated situation for sure. Let's get another call in here. Philip in Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Philip. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. I wanted to respond to a couple different callers' comments.
Okay.
Well, one caller said that water vapor is a greenhouse gas and that nuclear power emits water vapor. But water vapor has very quick turnover in the atmosphere. You see that every time that it rains. So it's not the kind of concern that we would have with carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide in the atmosphere that stay in there for a long time. But what I am concerned with is that there's a limited lifetime of nuclear power plants. And another thing is, as lots of people have mentioned, it's not carbon neutral, that there's carbon emitted in the construction, just as with wind or solar. I do think that it's part of the solution to get us towards carbon neutral, but really I think what we need is power sources that actually remove carbon from the atmosphere, like biomass sources, things where you're growing plants or trees to be able to use those to generate electricity. Mm.
Philip, thank you. Thank you very much. Let me ask the panel here, is there a stone that we've left unturned in this conversation? Is there something that we can or must do besides, you know, the carbon caps, besides wind, water, solar, nuclear, natural gas, scrubbing coal exhaust? I mean, there's a lot to this conversation. Is there something more we should be focusing on, Allison McFarlane?
Well, I think it's urgent that we act soon to try to reduce our carbon output. We don't really have any time to play with anymore, and we need to throw everything at it that we can. We need to go full bore at this. We can't sit around and twiddle our thumbs and ask for more research any longer.
Josh,
it's time to act.
Josh Fried, what's the biggest hurdle to your mind to nuclear energy at this point? Is it public resistance? Is it industrial capacity? What is it?
No, look, I think that it's the idea that we have to move immediately now on everything. And if a technology isn't ready, if it's going to take more than 1 or 2 years to deploy, then we might as well raise our hands and give up. The reality is, we do have time, and we are going to have to address climate change whether we get to the 2-degree threshold, the 3-degree threshold, or lighter, longer. And that's why we saw the United States joined by 20 countries. We saw Bill Gates and others investing a significant amount of money into R&D so that we can get nuclear technologies innovating and other technologies, and we will solve the problem.
To be continued for sure. Josh Fried, Vice President for the Clean Energy Program at the Third Way. Josh, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Mark Jacobson, Director of the Atmosphere and Energy Program at Stanford University. Mark, great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Allison McFarlane, former head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and now Director of the Center for International Science and Technology Policy at George Washington University. Great to have you with us, Alan. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.